it's your Polycast for Wednesday, August 30th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, what happens if Governor Mark Dayton wins his Supreme Court appeal and the debate over the old Ford site in St. Paul. I've been out for a couple days from the Polycast because I've been dealing with some crises. Anyway, you must know by now that the Minnesota Supreme Court heard the appeal of Governor Mark Dayton the other day in the case that the legislature filed against him for his vetoes, his line item vetoes of funding for the House and Senate. The court could rule any day now. Nothing much changes if the justices uphold a lower court ruling that went against Dayton and voided those vetoes. But if Dayton wins, legislative leaders contend it will tip the balance of power at the Capitol. It will also require them to decide how to keep the lights on at the House and the Senate. Tim Pugmire has more.
Heading into Monday's Supreme Court hearing on the governor's appeal, Republican Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka was confident the legislature would prevail. The next day, after reflecting on the 80 minutes of oral arguments, Gazelka was less sure.
The separation of powers issue, I think, to me, it feels very clear, but based on the questions I heard from the judges, I'm not 100% sure, because they had broad questions on that seemed to indicate, you know, pondering both sides of the issue, which is what they're supposed to do. But I hope in the end that they rule that he does not have what I think is extra power.
The power that Gazelka sees as extra is an unrestricted line item veto authority that Dayton and his lawyer contend he always had under the state constitution. The legislature and its lawyer countered that zeroing out their funding goes too far by harming a co-equal branch of government. Gazelka doesn't want Dayton or any future governor to do it again.
We'd have to rethink everything. You know, how do we work around the fact that he could take our funding away at, you know, any budget cycle? And so we would have to have a whole new strategy.
Dayton's vetoes took $130 million away from the House and Senate for the next 2 years. The two sides agreed earlier this summer to keep state money flowing to the House and Senate while they fight out the bigger issues in court. But that agreement expires October 1st. If the lower court ruling stands, the legislature gets its $130 million. But if Dayton wins, legislative leaders will have to make a choice. Do they tap their limited reserve funds to pay the bills until the 2018 session starts in February, or do they negotiate a deal with the governor on the budget? Dayton wants lawmakers to undo tax cuts on premium cigars, estates, and business property that were in a larger tax bill he signed into law. He also wants to reverse some policy provisions in other bills, including changes made to the teacher licensing system. Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd still isn't budging.
He agreed to what was in there. He agreed to it through negotiations. He then signed them into law and then attempted to get us to come back and change those things that he maybe didn't like. It doesn't work like that.
Dayton has also dug in his heels. During a state fair interview last week, he repeated his pledge to fight the Republican-backed tax cuts that he signed, no matter what happens in court.
You know, if you take $1 billion for each year or the next 2 years out of the state revenues, we'd go from budget surpluses to budget deficits. And they're putting Minnesota right on the precipice once again. And if I win or lose the Supreme Court decision, I'm going to bring that issue back to the legislature next session.
On the balance of power issue, Dayton's lawyer made an argument before the Supreme Court this week that was the exact opposite of the legislature's claim. Sam Hansen said a ruling against the governor would limit his line item veto authority and give the House and Senate an advantage in future budget negotiations. Covering politics, I'm Tim Pugmire at the Capitol.
About a month from now, St. Paul City Council members are expected to decide whether to approve a master plan for the old Ford plant site. The proposal calls for a mix of uses, including office space, retail, and housing. But just how many people the 135-acre chunk of land could accommodate has been a topic of fierce debate in the Highland Park neighborhood of St. Paul. Matt Sepik has the story.
The last Ford Ranger rolled out of the Twin Cities Assembly Plant nearly 6 years ago, bringing an end to almost nine decades of automobile production in St. Paul. But even before the factory closed in 2011, many in the Riverside neighborhood were already debating what would replace it.
No,
Outside Gloria Day Lutheran Church last night, that debate showed no signs of slowing down. As his neighbors trickled into a public meeting at the church, Brandon Long handed out green stickers reading, "Say yes to the Ford site plan."
Oh, a sticker or a sign?
The City Planning Commission approved the proposal earlier this month. Along with retail shops and offices that would employ around 1,500 people, the plan also includes up to 4,000 housing units. Some would be in buildings as tall as 10 stories. Long likes that. He and other members of the group Sustain Ward 3 say that kind of high-density development is exactly what the area needs.
We have a housing crisis. We need to provide houses for people. Also, we really support walkable communities, communities that are really highly connected with transit. We think that the master plan does those things. And then fiscally, we have a huge hole in our budget in the city, so we really need to expand that tax base.
Planners say 21% of the site should be public parks, trails, and open space. Long says he's not too worried about the additional traffic that an influx of people would bring. After all, he says the development will replace a major industrial operation that employed 2,100 people at its peak. But traffic is a big concern for many longtime Highland Park residents, including Charles Hathaway. Ahead of the meeting, he stood a few feet away from Long, handing out red signs that said, "Stop the Ford plan, rethink the development." Hathaway fears all the new residents and workers will mean all-day traffic jams along Ford Parkway, Creighton, and Cleveland Avenues. And he says the proposal just doesn't fit a quiet neighborhood of mostly single-family mid-20th century homes.
What's needed there is something that would actually make the neighborhood more beautiful, would enhance the neighborhood, and what the city's proposed is nothing like that. What we'd like to see is something far less dense and something that actually is in character with and blends with the neighborhood.
Hathaway is part of another group called Neighbors for a Livable St. Paul. He says a proposed compromise from Councilmember Chris Tolbert doesn't go far enough in reducing density. During the meeting, Tolbert told the standing room only crowd that he wants to limit the tallest buildings to 6 stories instead of 10, or else force the site's developer to add even more parkland.
One of the things that I've heard, by and large, is we want a mixed-use development, but we also want more open and green space. And I think that's a good balance for a developer to choose if they do want to go higher than 6 stories, to give that extra green space and open space to the neighborhood and to the community that will be built there.
The St. Paul City Council takes up the development proposal next week. A public hearing is scheduled for September 20th. Planning and Economic Development Director Jonathan Sage Martinson says Ford expects to put the site on the market as soon as this year and may choose a developer in 2019 or 2020. Sage Martinson says whoever purchases the site will have to draw up a highly detailed master plan that'll undergo an environmental review. He says the earliest any construction would begin is 2021. A decade after the assembly plant closed. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Staying in St. Paul, there's a thin strip of land on the east side of the city that doesn't look like it could be used for much of anything. But a Minnesota developer has a plan to build more than 50 tiny houses there. It's one of two tiny house projects currently being planned in the Twin Cities. It capitalizes on a national trend that some are even calling a movement of going tiny to live more simply. But before the houses can be built in St. Paul, they have some big hurdles to overcome. Max Nesterak has more.
Lauren Sherber was looking for a place to build a tiny house village when he found this abandoned parcel of land less than a mile east of downtown St. Paul.
It was sitting on a website under Ramsey County for $65,000. So very affordable for 3 acres of land in the city.
He bought it on a whim last fall and began sketching out plans for the East Yard Cooperative. It's a whole tiny neighborhood with 52 tiny houses, a community center, and a dog run. Right now, it doesn't look like much, just a bunch of broken up blacktop and overgrown weeds. But Sherber has a vision.
Where we're walking now will be a corridor down the middle of a set of tiny houses, and we'll be heading right about through some gardens and kind of a community meeting space, outdoor community meeting space.
The houses Sherber wants to build range in size from about a 1 to a 2-car garage.
280 square feet up to 530 square feet.
Each will have a loft for sleeping, as well as all the amenities of regular size living.
Today's building codes have to have foundations and plumbing, and they're not tiny houses on wheels like you see on TV.
And since living space is tight, Chura's plans include lots of communal spaces.
Raised flower beds, chickens we're envisioning having, bees. It's really going to be, a lot of the things are up to the members who decide to buy into this cooperative.
The whole neighborhood will be owned collectively by everyone who lives there and run kind of like a homeowners association. Sherber estimates the price of his tiny houses will range from about $130,000 to $170,000.
All told, we're looking at costs that are in $1,000 to $1,100 a month.
It's not the most affordable housing you can find in the cities, especially in this neighborhood, but it's well within reach for many first-time homebuyers or retirees who want to downsize. Now, there are quite a few reasons not to build a tiny house cooperative village on this particular lot. For starters, it's literally right next to a railroad. Is this an active rail track?
This is an active rail track, yep.
Wow. So that's like, so you're gonna like be right up next to the...
Mm-hmm.
The noise alone makes the neighbors just across the street skeptical of the project. Dick Galay has lived here for 21 years.
Gosh, you know, I'd wish him luck, but no. I don't know how anybody could ever move in there. Even at night, we get used to them trains. Sometimes, you know, when they hump, they just bang when they take off or when they stop. I'll tell you what, this old house will shake.
Then there's this place's sordid past. The lot Sherber bought used to be a toxic waste dump, and before that, it was a rail yard.
That is high in mercury and lead.
Which means he'll need to find some grant money to clean it up. At a public interest meeting recently, residents of the area raised another concern.
Again, it's gentrification.
Gentrification. Here's Eastsider Paris Yarbrough.
People want to talk about tiny homes. We're losing affordable units at an alarming rate. So where are these people going to go? They're not going to go in tiny homes because the average Eastsider can't live in a tiny home.
While technically affordable, Yarbrough says a tiny house is impractical for many Eastsiders who have blended multi-generational families. And she fears these new, trendy tiny houses will attract outsiders with more money than the rest of the neighborhood. And if that happens, won't it force out the people who currently live there? I put this question to the council people who represent this area, as well as University of Minnesota law professor Myron Orfield. He published a study of gentrification in the Twin Cities last year. They all said no.
It doesn't look like there's much evidence of gentrification over there. The neighborhoods are becoming much poorer. You'd have to have a tidal wave of yuppies to have even a tiny dent in a neighborhood like that. There's almost no chance that it would have any effect.
Orfield said St. Paul's East Side could use more economic diversity. The added revenue could help improve roads and schools and business. Still, for people who live here, it can be hard to think about your neighborhood changing, even if it's only a tiny bit. With reporting from Ariana Giles, I'm Max Nesterak, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Wednesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.